Hi, Chris Bentley here. Thanks for downloading this episode of Here and Now Anytime. We have some great stories in the works, deep dives on the arts, the environment, childcare, and much more. To get those, plus the top news of the day, make sure you subscribe or follow us in the app of your choice. Just search for Here and Now Anytime. And if you're already subscribed, I'd love it if you told a friend about us. And thanks. Now here's the show.
We continue to work collectively and make sure that we create a positive future for the river and the 40 million people who rely upon it.
Western states have agreed to a landmark plan to protect the Colorado River. It's Tuesday, May 23rd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Ashley Locke, in for Chris Bentley. Today on the show, more than half of adults see climate change as a major threat to the country's well-being. But most states don't require kids to learn about it in school.
If I was to give a grade and we were using the pass-fail system, you know, we're failing.
And before kids are school-aged, their experiences as babies and toddlers can impact their brain development and their physical health as they become adults.
There's always a genetic predisposition to some of these conditions, but genes alone do not predict heart disease, diabetes. Everything's about relative risk.
But first, a breakthrough and a milestone. Those are some of the words used to describe a deal to protect the Colorado River from reaching critically low levels. Under the deal announced yesterday, the federal government would pay water districts, cities, and native tribes in California, Arizona, and Nevada to agree to voluntary cuts in water use for the next 3 years. The Biden administration will now review the plan. We're going to hear perspectives from two states. Scott Tong spoke with Arizona's lead water negotiator, Tom Buschotsky. He's director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources.
So under this agreement, which I gather the federal government, the Interior Department, is still analyzing and taking a look at, how much will the people of Arizona have to cut back on water use? How will everyday life change?
So there are already some cuts that are occurring in Arizona. Most of those cuts have come to Central Arizona farmers. What this avoided was additional cuts, and the way this proposal works out is water users can voluntarily put their water on the table to be reduced in relation for compensation. And so this allows folks to basically decide their own futures in terms of their reduced water use and do it in a way that they can handle it appropriately.
Does the federal government have to come back and say, yes, this is enough, or perhaps this is not enough?
That is one of the things the federal government will analyze, yes. But we, the states, as you can imagine, already analyzed this in our minds, and we believe that they will protect Lake Powell and Lake Mead, but also because we had a good winter and the federal government's draft environmental impact statement was using fall conditions from last year, which were much worse than they are now.
Before you got a whole lot of rain and snowpack to make conditions more favorable than they were in the fall.
Right.
And just before we let you go, for persons in the Phoenix and Tucson areas, how will this affect them? Will they also be asked to come forward if they choose to use less water, families?
So it's the cities, the city water providers who are the ones who have opportunity to put their water on the table. I don't think that those homeowners are going to be asked or mandated to reduce their water use. Most of our water use here, 70% or so, is outdoors, not indoors. Mm. So I think it's a good partnership, and there is value in homeowners and businesses conserving water so that the water providers, the cities, have the flexibility to participate in these types of programs.
Tom Buschotsky is director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, and he's the state of Arizona's lead water negotiator in these Colorado River talks. Tom, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now let's get the view from California, which draws most water from the Colorado River and is the state with the most water rights under century-old rules. Wade Crowfoot is Secretary of California's Natural Resources Agency. Secretary, California is in the hot seat. Now, it gave up some of its historic water rights temporarily to reach this historic agreement, but it's still only about half the amount of reductions that federal officials wanted. My question to you, sir, is should California have given up more to share the water more equitably?
Well, I'll start by sharing that 40 million Americans get their water from the Colorado River, and half of those folks are in California. We recognize that the future of the Colorado River is going to look different than the past. Climate change means hotter temperatures, longer droughts, less water year over year. So California water agencies have been preparing for that reality for some time. 20 years ago, we initiated the largest agricultural to urban water transfer within California to reduce our use of the Colorado River water. And we've continued that up until last fall when we actually stepped up and volunteered to reduce our water use even before a deal came together. So we recognize that California water agencies need to reduce their water use over time, as do water users from across the Colorado River Basin.
Yeah. You know, I live here in California, and I think many of us feel like we've done our share of conserving water throughout this epic drought in urban areas and households. I want you to tell me what I and other people living in cities don't understand about the water needs of farmers in places like the California Imperial Valley.
Well, I think most of us at this point in time, you know, go to the grocery store and we go to the supermarket and we purchase produce, really any type of produce that we want. And few of us understand all of the water that goes into all of that produce, regardless of what kind of produce and where it's grown. So, you know, the food we eat, whether it's, you know, crops or meat or even the clothes we wear, takes a lot of water. And so in any place around the world where there's significant agriculture activity, most of the water is used for agriculture. And that obviously sustains us. And so even if we're not farmers ourselves, we recognize that, you know, the water that we use across this region is putting food on our table.
We only have a few seconds left. Have you got the Upper Basin buy-in on this? We heard that they may not have signed off yet.
Well, this has primarily been a lower basin plan because it's really our three states that have to put together the plan. That being said, we're glad that the Upper Basin joined the Lower Basin in a letter, and all seven states requested that the federal government assess this plan for its feasibility over the next 3 years.
Okay. We'll continue to follow this. Wade Crowfoot is Secretary of California's Natural Resource Agency. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, with climate change education lacking in schools, Deepa talks with a science writer about how to inspire children to pay attention to the world around them. That's after the break. Climate change is at our doorstep, and yet children may not be learning much about it in school. New Jersey, Oregon, Connecticut, and California feature climate topics or environmental education in their curriculum. But most states don't require teachers to give lessons on climate change, and educators who want to teach it often don't have the resources. Jennifer Jones directs the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She tells Deepa Fernandez our youngest Americans lack a foundation in what she calls climate literacy.
We think about the science. A climate literate person should understand the basic science and systems regarding climate change. But we need to go further than that. We need to understand the uneven impacts of climate change on people, disproportionately affects communities of color, marginalized communities. A climate literate person is somebody who can distinguish credible and non-credible sources of information. They can recognize disinformation. And finally, a climate literate person is somebody who can communicate in a meaningful way about climate change in their community and society as a whole.
Yeah, you know, as I'm listening to you, Jen, I think as the mother of two teenagers now, that their lives are going to be basically dealing with climate change a lot, and that I want them to have the tools to do that.
How early should this climate literacy education start?
It is never too early. It's about making sure that it's grade appropriate, and that's where the use of state standards can come in and help target that incremental learning for students. But right now, we're not even doing that in most states.
So what are we doing? What is the state of climate literacy in the country right now in education?
You know, yeah, if I was to give a grade and we were using the pass-fail system, you know, we're failing. If we look at the national level, we look at recent reports coming out of the North American Association for Environmental Education and some other institutes, we see that teachers lack resources. They lack training. And because it's not included in state standards, they're not given the time and space, and nor do they feel like they have the political support and administrative support to bring climate change into the classroom.
And I wonder, you know, we're seeing so many attacks on books and things like race and gender and sexuality. Have climate change theme books come under attack as well?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we see within the climate change as a whole a very coordinated disinformation campaign, largely held up by fossil fuels, but certainly others delegitimizing the science of climate change, trying to sow doubt about climate change.
And if teachers or educators or parents are in a state and they want to see it in their state standards, how do you go about doing that as a concerned citizen to make sure that children are learning it?
So we all have a role to play in getting climate change into our classrooms. Our kids and teachers want it. I would encourage all of us to use your own communication skills to contact your schools and your school boards and your elected representatives. Go to the ballot box with climate change end mind and be an active participant in creating this world we want.
Jennifer Jones is director of the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Jen, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to bring in now writer Mary Batten. She's joining us to elaborate further on how to make stories about science that incorporate climate change more accessible to children. Over the past 30 years, she's worked on dozens of science-themed shows for children and has written 24 books. Her latest children's book, Life in Hot Water, Wildlife at the Bottom of the Ocean, was just named by the National Science Teaching Association to the list of outstanding science trade books for students K through 12. Mary is in Smithfield, Virginia. Welcome, Mary, to Here and Now.
Hi, Deepa. Thank you.
Yeah, Mary, your latest book is about a really fascinating but complicated subject, the organisms that thrive in scalding hot water at the bottom of the ocean. I knew nothing about this until I read your book. And you say your first approach to make this topic appealing to children is to think about it as a story of discovery. Why?
Well, I view most nature stories as stories of discovery. There's so many fascinating things going on in nature, and each does tell a story. In this case of the hydrothermal vents, it's a story, first of all, of discovering that they existed, and then secondly, it's the discovery of what happens down at the bottom of the sea where the liquid earth interacts with the solid earth. And then third, it's the discovery that life is down there where no one, not even the scientists who made the first trip to the bottom of the sea, no one expected to find any living thing in the super hot and also highly toxic conditions.
Yeah. You know, Mary, I was telling our producer, Ashley Locke, before we began this, that it just really blew my mind. In one children's book, I learned more than I think I've learned in a long time about science and the climate. And one of the things that I loved is that you don't write down to children. And I know that you say you write up to them. What does that mean?
That means that I respect their questions. Children ask probing questions, and I think people really underestimate how intelligent some of the questions really are. Some are quite profound. Some years ago, when my daughter was 4 years old, she blew my mind by asking me, "Mom, does the universe have an edge?" And I said, "Oh," I gasped, really, when she asked. And I said, "Well, that's something that scientists have been trying to figure out for hundreds and hundreds of years." I think people do sometimes tend to think that science writers, that writers of literature for children write down to them. And absolutely not. That's not the thing to do. The thing is to respect their questions, answer them the best that you can, and you don't have to use one-syllable words all the time. I mean, my four-year-old grandson, he has absolutely no trouble saying Tyrannosaurus. That's a five-syllable word. So that's what I mean by I write up.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I have gathered from reading your range of books is that no topic really seems off-limit, especially for children when it comes to science. How young do you think children can start really absorbing this information?
Well, let me pick up on something that Jennifer said. She said it's never too young. And that is my feeling, too, because toddlers in particular, I regard as budding field biologists. And if you play with a child, especially outdoors, you will notice that they pick up tiny fragments of the environment. They may pick up a little pebble, a leaf, a shell, a twig of grass, a buttercup. And they'll hold it in tightly in their little hands and run over to you excitedly and open the hand to give this treasure that they have found to you. So to me, the perfect time to introduce science is when the children are developmentally driven by that curiosity. That's when you do it.
To end, Mary, I know you're concerned about the political climate we're in now when it comes to climate literacy. Why are you worried, and what do you think we can do to maybe turn it around?
Well, it is a terrible climate, political climate, to use climate, the word climate in a different way. I never thought that I would see grown-up people in positions of leadership, the former president, members of Congress, governors, state legislators, and school board members working so hard to de-educate people. The book bannings, the defunding of libraries, telling teachers what they can and cannot teach. These are already having a devastating effect on education, and these self-appointed censors have what they've unleashed, really, is a pandemic of fear and ignorance. So this is something that I think we as science writers, as writers of any genre, as well as the scientists themselves, as Jennifer talks so well about, we have a pressing and urgent responsibility to counter these basically totalitarian things that are going on in our country. It is truly shocking. And it's a disservice to our children and politically a disservice to democracy because we need informed citizens.
Well, reading Life in Hot Water, Wildlife at the Bottom of the Ocean is a great place to start for adults and children. Mary Batten is the author. Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, as soon as our kids are born, we want to be able to provide them with food, shelter, and most of all, love. Those ingredients are important for brain development, but science shows us they also matter for lifelong health and well-being.
Pediatricians have long known that early experiences like responsive, nurturing relationships with caregivers and sound nutrition are important for a child's brain development. Now, researchers are learning more about how these early influences can impact a child's immune, metabolic, and cardiovascular system as they get older. The health implications can be lifelong. Joining us to talk through some of the latest science behind early childhood development is Dr. Jack Schoenkopf. He's the director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Jack, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Deepa. Great to be with you.
So when I mention early experiences or influences, tell me what that means in real life.
Right. So if we're talking about babies, we're talking about very young children, so the active ingredient of their experiences is their interaction with the important adults in their life who are taking care of them. So we actually describe the best experiences of what we call serve and return interactions. Mm. So a baby coos or smiles and an adult smiles back. We can't help it. We're wired to do that. But it's basically these most of the important experiences are in the context of those person-to-person relationships between children and the adults who are caring for them.
And that serve and return that you just described, yep, that's a direct line to brain development. Tell us how.
Absolutely. So the brain is wired genetically to engage in interactions with adult caregivers because this is basic biology, and humans are the most helpless for the longest period of time. So this is really necessary for survival. So when there is that interaction and it's responsive, it builds strong circuits in all the different areas of the brain. When those interactions are not there, either because of a very severe neglect or very disruptive interactions, it signals danger mm. to the whole body and it activates the stress response system. Mm. And so that's the key of what early experiences are about. If they're interactive, the brain develops, children develop skills. If they're not interactive, the stress system gets activated.
And why does it matter to, I mean, so those are two extremes. There's just a lot in between where you've got busy parents who can't, yeah, you can't give your child every serve you can't return, or maybe you're just busy on your phone and you're not returning. What does it matter to do that serve and return and to put that attention in terms of brain development?
Thank you for that question. It's so important. So we're not that fragile, right? So that there are no situations where babies are responded to every moment that they're
okay,
awake.
Okay, good. So we don't have to feel guilty if we can't do it every second.
Good parents feel guilty about everything all the time, but don't feel guilty about this. In fact, if we were that dependent on interaction every second of the day, we'd be like the dinosaurs, we'd be extinct. So no, you can overdo it. It's not that refined.
Okay, great. A lot of people are breathing a sigh of relief right now, Jack. So the same science on brain is now seeming to apply to other biological systems. That means a child can be at risk for some serious health conditions, as I mentioned, as they get older. Let's take cardiovascular disease. That's something I don't think we think about in little children. But what are researchers finding about this impact on the heart?
Well, inflammation is one of the major components of the stress response system. So when children have stress systems that are activated all the time at a very high level, they're in an inflammatory state, and we know that that's associated with increased atherosclerosis and risk for heart disease. Now, there's always a genetic predisposition to some of these conditions, but genes alone do not predict heart disease, diabetes. Everything's about relative risk, and when the stress system is overactivated, between inflammation and insulin resistance, we have two biological responses that we know are very much a part of the most common chronic diseases.
And what I hear you saying is it's not like a small child, an infant or a toddler is going to have a heart problem now. It's that they're starting to accumulate what might turn into
exactly an starting
issue later.
To accumulate in those children who may be more prone to this. But if you take all of the children who are in stressful situations, most do not develop heart disease. But more children who experience early trauma have these conditions than children who don't experience it.
And I imagine, Jack, you might have a quick word of advice for policymakers. How can they keep this in mind when making policy?
So even though we think about the return on investment in terms of educational achievement and people being economically self-sufficient later and not requiring public assistance, for the same interventions and the same protective environments, we get less heart disease, we'll get less diabetes, we'll get less hypertension. We have to understand that children are raised by families. They're not raised by government. They're not raised by counties or states. But families who are raising children live in these environments, and the environment can either make it easier and support effective caregiving, or can make it harder. And there isn't anybody out there who doesn't know what it feels like when you're stressed out and you don't have the patience.
Absolutely.
And that's okay. You don't have to be patient. The best parents do a dozen things wrong every day. Okay. But the real issue is, are we as a society creating a supportive environment so that all families can raise healthy children? That's the key.
Dr. Jack Schoenkopf is the director of the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Jack, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Deepa. Thank you for letting me be here.
That's our show for today. Our stories were produced by me and Lynn Menegon. Today's editors were Gabe Bullard and Todd Munt. Technical direction from Mike Moschetto and Caleb Green. Theme music by Chris Bentley, Mike, and Max Liebman. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you next time.